that out. But when I'm injured, my body doesn't respond. In other words, as long as he could still compete and win, Tiger determined that he wasn't injured. He looked at the situation as if through a straw, focusing solely on the here and now. With his body breaking down and his personal life in turmoil, Woods maintained a single-minded approach to competition, playing some of the best golf of his life. He started the 2008 PGA Tour season the same way he had ended the 07 season, winning. He won the first three tournaments he entered, the Buick Invitational, the WGC Accenture Match Play Championship, and the Arnold Palmer Invitational. But with each tournament, the pain in his knee intensified. By the time he got to the 2008 Masters, he admitted to Hank Haney that he was hurting. At the same time, he had no intention of stopping. "Nothing that some drugs can't take care of," he told Haney. "I'm fine." The first reported instance of Tiger using painkillers during a tournament was 2002, when he experienced constant aching in his knee. By 2008, the pain was more severe, and according to his trainer, Woods used Vicodin at the 2008 Masters to manage the extreme pain in his left knee. He finished in second place at Augusta, just three strokes behind the winner, an amazing achievement given the grave condition of his ACL. But he would have won easily if his putting hadn't been so uncharacteristically off. Putting, more than any other aspect of golf, is a function of touch and feel, both of which can be compromised by pain medication. 2 days after leaving Augusta, Tiger underwent knee surgery in Park City, Utah. "I made the decision to deal with the pain and schedule the surgery for after the Masters," Woods announced on his website. "The upside is that I have been through this process before and I know how to handle it. I look forward to working through the rehabilitation process and getting back to action as quickly as I can." But the surgery didn't go quite as planned. Orthopedic surgeons Thomas Rosenberg and Vern Cooley, who had operated on Tiger's left ACL in 2002, intended to clean up some of the damaged cartilage around his knee. It should have been a fairly simple procedure that would have alleviated pain and enabled Woods to return to the tour in time for the U.S. Open 7 weeks later. But after scoping his knee, they made a surprising discovery. Tiger's ACL was completely torn, meaning he needed ACL ligament replacement surgery. From a medical standpoint, it was hard to reconcile the condition of Tiger's knee with his performance. He had won 9 of his previous 12 tournaments, and he'd done it with a severely compromised left knee. In the 3 tournaments he didn't win during that stretch, he'd finished 2nd twice and 5th once. To put this in context, during this period, Tiger was winning more frequently than he had in 2000, when he turned in the greatest season in golf history, or in 2006, when he played the finest golf of his career. Rosenberg's instinct was to reconstruct Tiger's ACL while the knee was open. But Woods was unconscious and had consented only to having loose cartilage removed from his left knee joint. The more extensive reconstruction procedure would force him to miss the remaining 3 major championships, and Rosenberg wasn't about to do that without Tiger's okay. So he left the shredded ACL alone, choosing instead to clean up the cartilage as best he could. It was a stopgap measure that would potentially enable Woods to play through the summer. Possessing an extremely high tolerance for pain, Tiger had been able to play for approximately 9 months without an ACL, thanks in large part to the unusually strong muscles he had built up around his knee. Those muscles were a byproduct of his weightlifting routine. But in the aftermath of his surgery in April, those muscles naturally weakened, compromising the only remaining support around the knee. Swelling, soreness, and stiffness set in. Nevertheless, with his sights set on returning to the PGA Tour at the Memorial Tournament on May 26th, Tiger resumed hitting balls in mid-May. While practicing one day at Isleworth, he felt a crack just below his left knee. 2 days later, Haney showed up in Orlando. That night, Sunday, May 18th, 2008, Tiger and Elin had Haney over for dinner. When Tiger got up from the table, he immediately stopped and bent over, grimacing with his eyes closed. Worried, Haney and Elin looked at each other. "I'm fine," Tiger said. "Tiger, you can't even walk," Haney said. "How are you going to be able to play?" The next day, Woods was limping so badly that he decided to withdraw from the memorial and undergo an MRI. Days later, Dr. Rosenberg and a colleague flew out from Utah to go over the results. The mood was grim as Tiger and Haney sat on a couch in Tiger's living room while Rosenberg pulled up images on his laptop and pointed to 2 dark lines on the screen. Tiger's left tibia, he explained, had two stress fractures right below the knee. Silent, Tiger stared blankly at the fracture lines. The 2008 U.S. Open was just 2 weeks away at Torrey Pines Golf Course in La Jolla, California. Chiseled out of the coastal cliffs high above the Pacific Ocean, Torrey Pines boasted panoramic views and breathtaking vistas. For the average golfer, it was paradise. But tour pros saw Torrey for what it was, and at the time, two scenic municipal courses owned by the city of San Diego won the North Course that annually ranked among their least favorites to play. Tiger, however, loved Torrey for its wide fairways and the fact that it had virtually no out-of-bounds. At age 15, he'd won a junior world title there. He'd since won six PGA Tour events at the course, including four in a row from 2005 to 2008, when he opened the season by winning the Buick Invitational. And from the moment the 2008 season began, he had fixated on playing there in the U.S. Open, more so than on the Masters or on any other tournament. He wanted to win on what he considered his home course in front of fans who cheered his every move. But a fractured tibia on top of a ruptured ACL seemed to foreclose any hope of collecting another major, prompting Haney to inquire about the standard treatment for stress fractures. 6 weeks on crutches, Rosenberg said, followed by a month of rehab. The math was clear. Tiger's season was over. 10 weeks out of action meant he would miss the British Open and the PGA Championship too. Tiger finally spoke up. I'm playing in the U.S. Open, and I'm going to win it. His voice was defiant, and Rosenberg wasn't about to challenge him. Tiger, you can try to play, he said. There's not too much more damage you can do at this point. It's just a matter of how much pain you can take. It's just pain, Woods said, bending over to put on his golf shoes. Come on, Hank, let's go practice. Earl Woods once described Tiger as the first golfer who was a true athlete. Those words in Tiger's mind meant tough, strong, and accustomed to dealing with pain the way football and basketball players did, which is to say, by ignoring it. That's just what we do as athletes and competitors, Tiger said. You have to deal with it. But it's trying to get up every day and knowing you have to go into the gym and bust your butt and it's going to hurt, and you're going to put yourself in a different place, a different state of mind. For me, I enjoyed that part of it. On the Saturday before U.S. Open week, Woods played 9 holes with Haney at Big Canyon Country Club in Newport Beach. It was, by any measure, a disaster. Wearing a bulky leg brace that looked like something you would expect to see on an offensive lineman, Woods couldn't rotate his lower body. As a result, he sprayed shots all over the course, into the rough, over fences, into hazards. After 9 holes, he actually ran out of balls. The brace was throwing off the mechanics of his swing. I can't play with this thing, he told Haney in frustration. On Rosenberg's orders, Tiger had been wearing the brace for weeks, but he decided to play the final 9 holes at Big Canyon without it. Haney figured that the pain of playing without the brace would finally persuade Tiger that his goal of participating in the U.S. Open simply wasn't realistic, but he underestimated Tiger's determination. Without the brace, Tiger limped noticeably when he walked, but his swing improved. Although the pain level went up a few ticks, the challenge of playing with a severe physical limitation seemed to invigorate him. Over the next few days, his game got a little better with each practice session. But the more time he spent on the golf course, the more the swelling increased around the stress fractures. The stiffness was getting worse, too. His physical therapist worked on him before and after each practice session, but Tiger refused to take prescription pain medication as he had done at the Masters. He would take nothing other than Motrin or Advil to help combat the swelling, and he was determined to fight through the pain. The PGA Tour's new drug testing policy was set to go into effect on July 1, 2008. Sometime between the end of the 2008 Masters and the start of the U.S. Open, Woods had his blood drawn and tested in what he told Hank Haney was a precaution against the supplements he was taking. That's the way he framed it, Haney said in a 2017 interview. They're going to start testing me. You can get all kinds of false positives. At one point, he said, Motrin can give you a false positive for marijuana. I've got to make sure none of these supplements I'm taking have anything in them. And then he took the blood test and said everything came back fine. The Open would be played solely on the South Course at Torrey Pines, at 7,628 yards, It was the longest in major championship history, toughened by gnarly, open-length, rough, pesky bunkers and multi-tiered greens. For the first time, the USGA had used the World Golf Rankings for pairings, which meant Woods, Mickelson, and Adam Scott, ranked 1, 2, and 3 in the world, would be grouped together on Thursday and Friday. Mickelson and Scott knew that Tiger was coming back from knee surgery, but no one outside of Woods' inner circle and his medical team knew that his ACL was ruptured, and that his tibia was fractured in two places. Tiger wanted it that way. Mickelson and Scott, in his mind, were soft, not real athletes. There was no way either of them would ever think about playing with a broken leg and no ACL. No other golfer would. Tiger knew he was climbing the biggest mountain of his career at Torrey Pines, said Haney, and it inspired him to an incredible achievement. Over four spectacularly uneven days, Woods showcased the utter genius of his game, particularly his putting. Wayward drives that led to four double bogeys were overshadowed by three astounding eagles, including a 65-foot downhill racer from the fringe when he really needed it on Saturday. Bogeys countered by birdies, an ugly 38 on the first nine on Friday reversed by a lights-out 30 on the back, and every single day, when it counted, a barrage of gut-wrenching putts for par. Woods held a one-shot lead over Lee Westwood and was too clear of Rocco Mediate going into Sunday. In his 13 previous wins at major championships, Woods had never lost a major when leading after three rounds. But with three holes to play, he found himself in uncharted waters. Down one to Mediate, a journeyman pro 147 spots below him in the world rankings. Westwood was still in the hunt, but about to fall victim to the Tiger effect. Everyone else within striking distance had already succumbed to the same illness, what one longtime tour regular loosely described as a bad case of nerves, and a shrinking ball sack. That was the week when guys were so petrified of Tiger, the insider said. Nobody had the nuts to get ahead of him that week. Nobody but Rocco Mediate. With one critical putt to go, Mediate was holding his breath and a one-stroke lead at one under par, watching on television outside the scorer's shack as Woods lined up a treacherous 15-foot putt for birdie. Tiger was 15 feet away because Steve Williams had the nuts to put his job on the line. Woods had flared his second shot to the par 5 18th hole into the right rough, 96 yards from the green, 101 from the hole. Woods wanted to hit a 56-degree sand wedge. But given the lie and Tiger's pumped-up demeanor, Williams argued for a full 60-degree wedge and backed the call with everything he had. "Tiger, you have to absolutely trust me on this one," Williams said. "And if I'm wrong, fire me. I know how much this means to you, so if I'm wrong, just fire me." Williams wasn't wrong. The shot landed about 20 feet past the hole on the right and trickled back down the slope, leaving Woods a chance for birdie to tie Mediate and force a playoff. The putt was a lot tougher than it looked. If Woods hit too high, it would stay high. If he got it too low, it would fall off. Basically, he needed his putt to ride a ridge. Adding to the stakes, it was late in the day, the greens were bumpy, and the ball was resting on one of the worst parts of the green. Woods told himself, 2.5 balls outside on the right. It's going to break late. Make a pure stroke and stay committed. So he hit it. The putt ran the ridge line like its life depended on it, then took a sharp left and banged into the right side of the cup. Instead of lipping out, it rattled in. Amid a roar that was heard by the hang gliders hovering over the Pacific a mile away, Tiger thrust his fists into the air and then slapped hands with Williams, the agonizing pain in his leg eclipsed by the adrenaline rush. Woods and Mediate were headed to an 18-hole playoff on Monday. "Unbelievable," Mediate said to himself as he watched Woods celebrating on the monitor. As soon as Tiger left the course, euphoria gave way to worry. He had geared himself up to play 72 holes, not 90. His knee and leg felt like they had been hit with 1,000 hammers. He spent the night with his physical therapist and told himself he would have to dig deeper than ever to make it through 18 holes the next day. During Monday's playoff round, Nike ran an ad featuring Earl Woods as if he were speaking to Tiger from the grave. "Tiger, I promise you that you'll never meet another person as mentally tough as you in your entire life," he said. Very few people knew just how tough he would need to be that day. For the longest time, Monday's playoff looked like a replay of the day before, all square through 14 holes. Throughout the day, Woods resembled an aging prizefighter, knocked to his knees by pain for one swing after another, only to rise to his feet and continue to fight. It was sporting drama of the highest order. Tiger trailed by one as he and Mediate stepped to the tee at the par 5 18th. And just as in Sunday's round, the best Mediate could do was par, leaving Woods a short birdie putt to force only the third sudden-death playoff in the U.S. Open since 1954. And that's when Mediate, a real fan favorite, finally faltered. A wayward drive on the first playoff hole at the par 4 7th left him in an awkward lie in a fairway bunker leading to a dead pull left of the green. The best Mediate could do was a bogey 5, opening the door for Woods. Tiger stuck a 9-iron in the center of the green from 157 yards away and two-putted for par and his third U.S. Open championship. Walking gingerly off the green, he got into a golf cart with Elin. At that moment, despite a damaged knee and a fractured tibia, the future never looked brighter for Woods. He was on the other side now, as he liked to call it, a father for the first time. At every opportunity, he talked about how he and E were a team in raising their daughter, Sam. Earlier in the year, Sam had crawled for the first time. Now she was walking, dragging a cut-down club around the house. This win at Torrey Pines could not have meant more. "It's probably the greatest tournament I've ever had," said Tiger. At 32, he had won his 14th major, a milestone Nicklaus didn't reach until he was 35. Tiger was on a trajectory to annihilate all of golf's records. The next day in the New York Times, columnist David Brooks called Woods the exemplar of mental discipline and declared that he had risen above mere human status and become an embodiment of immortal existence. At that moment, it would have been unthinkable, preposterous, to predict that the U.S. Open at Torrey Pines would be the final major championship in the career of Tiger Woods. Chapter 26, Miracle Workers. 8 days after the most extraordinary win of his career, Tiger underwent season-ending surgery at a clinic in Park City. A ligament was taken from his right hamstring and was used to reconstruct his left ACL. Afterward, he was told to remain off his left leg for 2 months. "Can I do push-ups?" Tiger asked. The answer was no. "Sit-ups?" "No again." "Upper body stuff?" "Still no." "What can I do?" Tiger insisted. Dr. Rosenberg wanted him to rest to give his body time to heal. The next months were two of the most difficult of Tiger's life. The deep, throbbing, aching pain never went away. He hated the post-surgery treatment because there was no adrenaline rush. He wanted to get back into the gym, but first he needed extensive rehab. Fortunately, Team Tiger knew exactly where to turn. By the summer of 2008, the name Dr. Mark Lindsay was being passed among elite athletes searching for state-of-the-art recovery techniques and the realignment of their bodies. A Toronto-based chiropractor known for his magic hands, Lindsay had worked with hundreds of athletes, including tennis star Maria Sharapova, Olympic sprinter Donovan Bailey, and New York Yankees infielder Alex Rodriguez. Lindsay's method was called ART, short for Active Release Technique, a controlled but aggressive combination of neuromuscular massage and stretching, designed to stimulate and release the fascia tissue beneath the skin and thereby maximize recovery and athletic performance. "It's like playing an instrument," Lindsay once told Canadian author Bob McKenzie. "You can be super bright, super intelligent, but it has to translate to tactile, to the hands. From my own experience getting treatments, you can tell right away when someone gets it, when someone has the touch. Sometimes I think, this is cool, this is my job." Woods had been introduced to Lindsay by professional volleyball star Gabby Reese, who had found her way to Lindsay through NFL linebacker Bill Romanowski, a four-time Super Bowl champion. In the late 90s, Romo was one of the first U.S. athletes to put his faith and career in Lindsay's hands. He would eventually go on to play a record 243 consecutive games at linebacker before retiring from the league in 2003. "Bottom line, Tiger's career was over if he didn't have Mark," said Romanowski. "Tiger was so locked up, his whole kinetic chain was messed up." About 6 weeks after the surgery, Lindsay sent Woods to Bill Knowles, a certified strength and conditioning specialist with 2 decades of experience working with world-class athletes. Knowles' area of expertise was alpine skiing, so he knew a blown-out knee when he saw one, and what he saw with Woods was not pretty. Let's just say the surgery was a very big surgery, Knowles recalled years later. Not a straightforward surgery, it was a very big operation. Woods and Knowles worked together on rehab 5 days a week for about 6 straight months, gym and pool, twice a day, up to 2 hours at a time. As Knowles reconditioned Woods' knee, he also worked on his body and mind. In mid-October, Tiger was cleared to start swinging a golf club. Dr. Rosenberg suggested he take it slowly, but Tiger began swinging at 35 miles per hour. Within a month, he was at 65 miles per hour and driving the ball 150 yards. He also stepped up his weightlifting routine, especially for his lower body. By the end of 2008, he was doing Olympic-style lifts. Tiger was on schedule to return to the tour at the start of the 2009 season, but right around his 33rd birthday, he injured his right Achilles tendon while working out. For the third time in a little over a year, one of the world's best-conditioned athletes suffered a serious injury while training. Psychologically, the Achilles injury was a huge setback. It threatened to derail Tiger's return. Dr. Lindsay recommended bringing in another Toronto-based sports medicine expert, Dr. Anthony Galea. Lindsay had first met Galea at the Winter Olympics in 1994, and they later shared office space for years. Galea was considered a pioneer in PRP, platelet-rich plasma therapy, a process whereby a small amount of blood is withdrawn from the injured athlete and then spun in a centrifuge separating red blood cells from the platelets. The resultant protein-rich plasma is then injected directly into the injured area, tendon, muscle, or ligament, catalyzing the body's instinct to repair itself and accelerating the healing process. It's very effective, Lindsay said. It's legal as long as you're fixing a legitimate injury. There are growth factors in the platelets. It's basically a form of stem cell, but it's your own tissue, no drugs, no foreign substances. It works best for hamstring tears, Achilles tears, and groin tears. That's why Tony and I worked so well together. Tony would treat the specific injury, and I would work on the body system. Tiger agreed to see Galea, who had to be in Tampa to treat Pittsburgh Steelers receiver Hines Ward in the lead-up to Super Bowl 43. Galea went directly from Tampa to Tiger's home in Isleworth. Like Lindsay, Galea was, by 2009, seen as something of a miracle worker, the go-to guy among elite athletes for injury and recovery procedures outside the medical norm. Galea cut a dramatic figure with his spiky black hair and feline features. His background was equally unusual. The son of a beautician and a bookkeeper, he had graduated with a medical degree from Canada's McMaster University before establishing his own clinic, the Institute of Sports Medicine Health and Wellness Center just outside Toronto. At 40, he divorced the mother of his 4 children and married a tennis pro less than half his age and fathered 3 more children. Galea's hobby was biblical archaeology, and he claimed to have had a spiritual awakening in an olive grove during one of his frequent trips to Jerusalem. In their book, Bloodsport, authors Tim Elfrink and Gus Garcia Roberts detail how Galea took a liking to the medical patents of a Miami area doctor named Alan R. Dunn, whose off-label use of human growth hormone consisted of scraping away scar tissue from inflamed joints and refilling the area with HGH. Galea had frequently cited Dunn in medical lectures, much to Dunn's dismay. "I would like to tell him to get lost," Dunn told Elfrink and Garcia Roberts. "I don't want any part of him." But increasingly, some of the most elite athletes in the United States and Canada did. Court documents suggest an extra incentive that Dr. Galea had available to get male athletes to seek his services, access to Viagra or Cialis for free and without fear of detection. When traveling from Canada to the U.S., Dr. Galea would instruct his medical assistant to prepare a checklist of items to enable him to treat patients, IV bags, IV tubing, ATP, German, syringes, ginseng, Nutripin, Activane, Centrifuge, Cialis, Viagra, Celebrex. Specifically, according to the U.S. government's 2009 indictment of Dr. Galea, he instructed his medical assistant to take Viagra and Cialis out of their original packages and put them in nondescript pill bottles so as to make detection of them less likely during border inspections. If asked by a patient, Dr. Galea would allegedly provide Viagra or Cialis free of charge and without a prescription. Viagra was the hook, said one athlete with direct knowledge of Galea's method of operation. The closer for athletes who didn't want to go to a doctor for a prescription. When Galea started treating Tiger, he would go to his home in Isleworth, and Tiger would lie down on the massage table in his family room. He winced as Galea placed a long needle directly into his injured Achilles tendon and injected platelet-rich plasma. The following day, Tiger's Achilles felt better. The next time Galea returned to Tiger's home, he injected his Achilles and knee with PRP. The doctor was living up to his reputation as a miracle worker. According to court records and other sources, Dr. Galea's unique medical services centered around four treatments: PRP, anti-inflammatory IVs, which contained, among other things, Actovane, an unapproved drug derived from calf's blood, injections containing Actovane, and injections containing a mixture of substances including but not limited to neutropin, a human growth hormone injected into the knee and administered for the purpose of regenerating cartilage and reducing joint inflammation. At the end of 2009, Dr. Galea told the New York Times that his preferred treatment for knee or ACL injuries was platelet-rich plasma. In the Times article, Dr. Galea said he had treated Woods' left knee solely with PRP using a centrifuge borrowed from an Orlando doctor and not with unapproved Actovane or any illegal performance-enhancing drug. He said he had treated Woods just 4 or 5 times, which turned out to be false. According to records later obtained as part of a Florida Department of Health investigation, Galea actually made 14 trips to treat Woods between January and August 2009, charging $3,500 per consultation plus expenses for first-class travel and lodging. Galea's total invoices amounted to more than $76,000. There's a very good chance Galea's work with Woods would not have become public if not for the events of September 14, 2009. On that day, Galea's longtime medical assistant was crossing the Peace Bridge connecting Canada and Buffalo, New York, when she was stopped by a U.S. Customs and Border Protection, CBP, officer and referred for a secondary inspection. During the inspection, CBP officers discovered, among other items, 111 syringes, a centrifuge machine, and a bag with 20 vials and 76 ampules of assorted substances and medications, including 10 milligrams of neutropin, synthetic HGH, and 250 milliliters of Actovane. The assistant told officers she was traveling to Washington, D.C. for a medical conference, which turned out to be untrue. She was actually taking what she described as Dr. Galea's medical kit to D.C. so he could treat an injured NFL player. Faced with criminal charges, the assistant began cooperating with agents from Homeland Security, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and the Food and Drug Administration. She eventually turned over her BlackBerry to investigators. A month later, on October 15, 2009, Canadian police raided Galea's office, seizing an NFL file folder and a professional player's journal. Galea was subsequently indicted in the U.S. by a federal grand jury on 5 counts, including possession of HGH with intent to distribute, and introducing misbranded drugs into interstate commerce. As part of its case, the government charged Dr. Galea with unlawfully entering the U.S. more than 100 times between July 2007 and September 2009 to illegally provide drugs and medical service to more than 20 professional athletes, including Woods. Billings during this more than 2-year period alone amounted to about $800,000. Galea later pled guilty to 1 count of introducing misbranded drugs into interstate commerce and was sentenced to 1 day in jail and a $275,000 fine. In an affidavit filed as part of an FBI investigation, Dr. Galea's longtime assistant appeared to contradict his assertion that PRP and Actovane were the sole treatment options for knee injuries. She told the government Dr. Galea would at times inject a cocktail containing HGH into an athlete. The HGH injections were designed to help regenerate cartilage growth. She also told authorities that Galea had injected at least 8 professional athletes, 7 in the U.S. and the other in Canada, with a mixture of substances that included human growth hormone. In an email, an attorney for the assistant insisted that she had never witnessed Dr. Galea injecting HGH into Woods. A close inspection of the government's case against Dr. Galea reveals what could be construed as an attempt to conceal the exact nature and history of his treatment of high-profile athletes. Invoices from Galea routinely described his services in vague terms, consultation or consultation IV injections. Checks were written to Galea Investments Incorporated and not to the doctor himself or to his health and wellness center. In defending his use of HGH, which was legal in Canada, but subject to extreme limitations in the U.S., Galea said he had injected the drug only in patients over 40 years old as a way to improve their health and stamina. Galea admitted he had personally used HGH for 10 years. So, Woods was getting some kind of pharmaceutical boost to speed his recovery from injury? One source with knowledge of Dr. Galea's treatment of Woods had no doubt. 100%, the source said, no question. According to the source, Galea's PRP injections into Woods' injured knee and Achilles also contained what the source described as minuscule amounts of both testosterone and HGH. All of those, the HGH, testosterone, and PRP, just worked together really well to create healing at that localized place of injection, said the source. There's just not enough testosterone in HGH, and it's so localized that there's just no way it would show up in a drug test. It would have been out of his system in a day. Tiger may not have known exactly what Tony was putting in there. No question has hovered over Woods more than whether he used performance-enhancing drugs. In a 2010 survey conducted by Sports Illustrated, 24% of the 71 PGA Tour pros who responded said they thought Woods used HGH or other performance-enhancing drugs. Those suspecting he used PEDs, particularly testosterone, have pointed to the muscular development of his upper body and arms beginning in the early 2000s, the need to recover from his twice-daily two-hour workouts, and his unusual, at least for golf, string of ligament and tendon injuries. Victor Conti is one of those who suspects Woods used PEDs. Conti was the man in the middle of the 2003 Balco steroid scandal. Now owner of a thriving nutritional supplement company, SNAC, Scientific Nutrition for Advanced Conditioning, he remains a knowledgeable resource on the current state and use of PEDs. Conti said Woods' injury history could be a sign of PEDs in the form of mineral depletion. When you use anabolic steroids, it depletes the body of copper, said Conti. So while you're simultaneously building your muscles with nitrogen and prompting protein synthesis from the use of steroids, you're weakening connective tissue, ligaments, and tendons. So when you describe his injury history, could that possibly be a result of his using anabolic steroids? And the answer is yes. Woods has consistently and categorically denied the use of performance-enhancing drugs. Dr. Galea did come to my house, Woods said at a Masters press conference in 2010. He never gave me HGH or PEDs. I've never taken that my entire life. I've never taken any illegal drug ever, for that matter. Dr. Galea also denies any suggestion that he was party to performance enhancement with Woods or any other athlete. Dr. Galea at no time has ever been engaged in any performance enhancement activity, said Galea's attorney, Brian H. Greenspan. These sorts of innuendo of suspicion are absolutely 100% false. Greenspan insisted that Woods had gone to Galea because he was a pioneer of PRP at the time and that Galea was a healer, not a cheater. Asked specifically if Galea had ever injected a cocktail of healing containing testosterone and HGH into Woods, Greenspan said Dr. Galea was unable to respond. In an email, Greenspan cited Galea's positive regulatory obligation to maintain the confidentiality of his patient's medical records, which cannot be disclosed without their express instructions in writing. Those who know the truth about Woods and whether he knowingly or otherwise used PEDs probably can be counted on the fingers of one hand. One of those people is almost certainly Dr. Mark Lindsay. Between September 15, 2008 and October 30, 2009, Lindsay treated Woods 49 times, charging $2,000 per day plus expenses, according to a Florida Department of Health investigation. He was paid a total of $118,979 for his services, including expenses. Lindsay has told friends his routine with Woods rarely varied. As soon as Tiger woke up, Lindsay would perform his specialized active release techniques on him. Woods would then go to practice and work out for the next 3 hours and then return home for lunch, after which Lindsay would work on him again. When Tiger was preparing for a major, Lindsay would often bring his therapeutic table to the range, where he would work on Woods for an hour in between practice sessions that focused on swing mechanics. The goal was to create efficiency and elasticity of the complex movements using the forces generated from the ground, Dr. Lindsay explained. The efficacy of doing this on-site and interchangeably with Tiger Woods' golf swings was significant. Lindsay's extensive treatment sessions with Woods provided unparalleled doctor-patient access during a time that some people suspect Tiger had gained an unfair advantage through PEDs. In a one-year span, from 2008 to 2009, Tiger underwent hundreds of hours of treatment at the hands of Dr. Lindsay. After initially declining to speak on the record, Dr. Lindsay, through his Toronto-based attorney, Timothy S.B. Danson, obtained a limited doctor-patient privilege waiver from Woods, authorizing him to disclose information about his treatment of the golfer and to provide his medical opinion on whether Woods used banned substances or performance-enhancing drugs. On December 17, 2017, Dr. Lindsay signed a four-page declaration witnessed by his attorney. With Tiger's consent, Lindsay provided his declaration to the authors of this book. It is the most authoritative and definitive statement to date on the question of whether Tiger Woods used performance-enhancing drugs. It reads in part, "During this extended period of time, I was very close to Tiger. At no time during this intensive process did I ever witness Tiger Woods take, discuss, or ask for any banned or performance-enhancing substances, nor did he even indirectly hint about the subject matter of banned substances. Anyone suggesting or implying otherwise is misinformed and wrong. To the contrary, Tiger Woods was fully committed to a proper and highly disciplined rehabilitation process. Tiger Woods is an exceptionally gifted, highly disciplined, and very spatially aware athlete. These qualities, along with his passion and single-minded commitment to be the best golfer of all time, are nothing short of breathtaking. They are what puts Tiger Woods in a very elite cohort of the best athletes in the history of sports. It is simply wrong and misconceived to apply normal standards of recovery and performance to world-class elite athletes like Tiger Woods. The exceptional and unique qualities that made Tiger Woods the best elite athlete in his field are the same exceptional and unique qualities that he applied to his rehabilitation and comeback. I have been in the practice of sports medicine for over 27 years. I have treated hundreds of world-class athletes spanning 8 Olympic Games and multiple professional sports disciplines. I know what muscle tone and tissue should feel like. This is critical to the proper treatment of a patient. I continue to be involved in research and stay current with the latest applicable medical literature. I understand body, muscle tone, and tissue and the effects of certain drugs on tone and tissue. Tiger Woods' body, muscle tone, and tissue are completely consistent with what one would expect from an elite athlete free of any performance enhancement drugs. Stated differently, there was no evidence of rigid, stiff, and hypertonic body, muscle tone, or tissue during my multiple physical examinations of Tiger Woods, which one would expect if performance-enhancing drugs were being used. With regard to my experience described above and my direct observations and treatment of Tiger Woods, it is my professional opinion that he has not taken any performance-enhancing substances, and that the notion of taking such substances would be abhorrent and repugnant to him. Tiger Woods is truly one of the most impressive, skilled, intense, and determined athletes I have ever worked with. These are the qualities and attributes that drive his rehabilitation and comeback. Chapter 27. Crash. It may have been the loudest cheering ever generated by Tiger Woods. At dusk on March 29, 2009, the gallery around the 18th hole at Bay Hill in Orlando could be heard a mile away as Tiger's 16-foot putt banged in, capping one of the biggest comebacks of his career. In his 239th start, Woods had won his 66th PGA Tour event. More important, the victory at the Arnold Palmer Invitational was his first tournament win since undergoing knee surgery 9 months earlier. The NBC announcers referred to Tiger's performance as magical. In this instance, adjectives like supernatural and otherworldly would not be exaggerations. It had been only 3 months since he had blown out his Achilles. The stress fractures in his tibia were healed, and he had a reconstructed ACL. Whatever Lindsay and Galea were doing was working. After starting the final round 5 strokes behind, Woods had come roaring back, demonstrating more emphatically than ever that he remained the greatest individual performer in all of sports. as Woods walked off the green to the chant of, "Tiger, Tiger, Tiger," he was greeted by the king, Arnold Palmer. "What did I say to you last year?" Palmer asked him. "I said Earl would have loved it." "He would have loved it." Woods smiled and thanked him. It felt exhilarating to be back on top. In Tiger's career, the year 2009 will forever be remembered for what happened to him off the course. A mysterious motor vehicle accident followed by the exposure of an infidelity crisis so big that he would never again be looked at in the same light. But his spectacular fall from grace would not come until the end of the year. Prior to that, Woods played some of the most remarkable golf of his life. He ended up winning 7 of the 19 tournaments he entered that season. In 16 of those tournaments, he finished in the top 10. He was first in birdie average, scoring average, iron play from 175 to 200 yards, and greens in regulation. He topped the money list with more than $10 million, and he finished the year ranked number one in the world. It was also the year that he became the first athlete in history to exceed $1 billion in career earnings. By every visible measure, Tiger Woods was alone at the pinnacle of professional sports, the most talented golfer to ever play the game, the greatest athlete of his generation, and the richest athlete of all time. But Woods was living in denial, deceiving himself and those closest to him. In February, he and Elin had welcomed their second child, Charlie Axel Woods, into the world. It should have been an occasion of immense joy, a family milestone that could have inspired Woods to spend more time with his wife and children. Many of the game's greatest golfers experienced at least a modest decline in their competitive edge after children came along and priorities changed. "When I was younger, before I had children and money, all I wanted to do was play golf, work at my golf, get better at my golf," Tom Watson said. "But then the children came. My time with them was very important to me. I definitely lost some edge." Woods, on the other hand, never lost his competitive drive to dominate his sport, to win every time he stepped onto a golf course. At 33, he was untethered from his family by a narcissism that fed his self-destructive addictions to bodybuilding, painkillers, sleeping pills, and sex. His upbringing, so critical to his development into a machine-like athlete, forever stunted his ability to form, much less maintain, the kind of intimate relationship with a spouse that is built on self-sacrifice, loyalty, trust, and selflessness. Nor was he equipped to cope with fatherhood. He loved his children, but his lifestyle virtually assured that he would be an absentee dad. In June 2009, Woods was in New York City to attend yet another promotional event, this time for EA Sports. The video game maker was rolling out a new product, and Tiger was on hand for the launch. Afterward, on the same day that Michael Jackson died after fatally overdosing on a cocktail of pain and sleep medications, an obviously worn-down Woods talked to People magazine writer Steve Helling. The subject quickly turned to parenting. "My dad passed away before Sam was born," Tiger told Helling. "So I didn't have a chance to talk to him about being a father. I regret that. I will always regret that. I think of him every day. He taught me everything. I hear his voice." There was a lot to unpack in that statement. Woods, who started taking Ambien to combat sleeplessness back when his father was dying, was still in the grip of insomnia. Racked by regrets stemming from the loss of his father and his own perceived inadequacies as a dad, Woods desperately missed communicating with his best friend. But the saddest part of Tiger's statement wasn't what he said, but who he said it to. Instead of opening up to his wife or a genuine friend, he was talking to a writer at a celebrity magazine. It was an indication that by 2009, Woods was more alone than ever. Yet he was signaling that he needed help. On the same day that Tiger talked to Helling, he met up with his friend Derek Jeter. They ended up at a Manhattan nightclub with three women in their 20s. One of the women in the group was Marc O'Meara's niece, Amber Loria. Tiger had known Loria since 1997 when they were introduced to each other at O'Meara's home. Woods had spent countless hours with Loria at Isleworth and around Orlando during her teenage years. From the beginning, their bond was more like a brother and sister relationship than a friendship. By 2009, Loria had graduated from college and was working at Fox News, and they would meet up from time to time when Woods was in New York. He also communicated with her frequently by phone and text. After Earl died, Loria said, her conversations with Tiger took on a more depressing tone. From that point on, he seldom seemed happy. He looked at me like a family member, Loria said, but I remember thinking he's in a really bad spot to be calling and crying and being this upset for this long. That's when I really started seeing a big change in him. He would just go to a dark place. Loria admired Elin and remembered thinking, I wish Elin were here with him at a time when he's so upset. But she also recognized that it wasn't practical for Elin to be on the road with Tiger. She had two young children at home. Loria agreed to meet up with Woods at the nightclub because she still cared about him as a friend. He was alone, and he needed people around him, she said. Still, it was clear that things were amiss. I said to him, I'm here for you, but you should be with your wife or calling your wife. I know you're traveling, but what's going on? Emotionally, Woods was adrift, constantly moving from city to city, hooking up with one woman after another. Most of the women whose names and numbers filled his cell phone directory were ones he had met in nightclubs and casinos. He persuaded one after another to believe that she was his only mistress. All of these women, the ones he paid and the ones he picked up, were women he could control. For the most part, they were younger than he was, less sophisticated, enamored of his status, and in the dark about his exploits. It was a situation that made it easier to maintain his secret life. But during his visit to New York City that week in June 2009, he met a woman who represented something different. 34-year-old Rachel Yucatel, a glamorous beauty, had grown up a child of privilege in Manhattan. Well-educated and possessing a degree in psychology, she first encountered fame after the 9/11 terror attacks. The New York Post ran a photo of her weeping while holding a picture of her missing fiancé, who worked in the World Trade Center, and the image was distributed around the world via the Internet. Yucatel went on to become a television producer at Bloomberg before transitioning to VIP hostess manager at high-end nightclubs from the Hamptons to New York to Las Vegas, earning high praise for her people skills and attention to detail. Yucatel gained another measure of fame when it was reported that she'd had an affair with actor David Boreanaz. She also knew Derek Jeter. Woods was taken with Yucatel. She was a year older than he was, and she lived a lifestyle that was more akin to his than the other women he knew. She was a jet-setter, accustomed to flying around the world and running in the same circles as celebrities and CEOs. By the time Tiger left New York, he'd added Yucatel to the directory on his phone, and she'd added him to hers, under the code name Bear. Yucatel started flying down to Orlando, where Tiger would put her up in a condo near his home. When Woods arrived, he would close the blinds. They would stay up watching late-night comedy on television. And despite being plagued by insomnia, Tiger didn't have trouble going to sleep when he was with Yucatel. Their sexual intimacy and mutual familiarity with grief, he was still suffering from the loss of his father, and she had lost her fiancé in an act of terrorism as well as her father to a cocaine overdose, enabled them to bond in a way that provided a deeper element to their relationship. On one occasion, while with Yucatel in the Orlando condo, Tiger said, "This makes me so happy." It was a sad admission, considering he was practically around the corner from his home, where Elin was taking care of their newborn son and 2-year-old daughter, blissfully unaware. At this point, Hank Haney didn't know what was going on either, but he recognized the drop-off in Tiger's practice hours and in his effort. There were times at Isleworth, Haney said, when I'd say, "Where is he?" I mean, he'd say he's going to the store, and he'd be gone for an hour or two. Or Elin would be out of town, and he'd be getting ready to go out. "Where are you going?" I'd ask, and he would make up some story about how he was going over to Brian Bell's house. I could tell he was lying. It had never crossed Haney's mind that Woods might be meeting up with other women. Haney was around Tiger more than almost anyone, and he said he'd never witnessed any flirting, never mind infidelity. "I never saw him with anybody," Haney said. "I'm the kind of friend that if I saw something, I would say something. Steve Williams was the same way." The one thing that Woods couldn't hide from Haney and Williams was his increasingly surly behavior on the golf course. Almost immediately after Woods returned to the tour in 2009, both his swing coach and his caddy started seeing red flags about his emotional state. The first one went up at the 2009 Masters. After playing poorly at Augusta, Woods went on a rant to the press. "I fought my swing all day and just kind of band-aided it around and almost won the tournament with a band-aid swing." Without naming Haney, Woods had given him a backhanded insult, igniting rumors that Haney was on the verge of being fired. Haney responded with an email to Woods. "You didn't make any friends or fans with the way you acted at the Masters. You just looked stressed and pissed the whole time you were there." It became even clearer that Woods was reaching the end of his emotional rope at the 2009 PGA Championship at Hazeltine National Golf Club outside Minneapolis. After scores of 67 and 70 in the first two rounds, Woods held a four-shot lead going into the third round. He appeared to be well on his way to closing within three majors of Nicklaus's record. But in Friday's post-round press conference, an enterprising reporter summoned the courage to inquire if Woods ever felt he had choked in a major. Furious, Woods just stared him down. Finally, moderator Kelly Elbin broke the awkward silence. "We'll take that to be a no," he said. "Be creative," Woods said finally to the reporter. "You usually are." But the question would prove prescient. After the third round, Woods maintained a two-stroke lead, and the outcome seemed like a foregone conclusion. Tiger had never lost a major when leading after three rounds. He entered the final round two strokes ahead of South Korea's Yang Yong-yun, better known as Y.E. Yang. Yang, who was 37, hadn't picked up a club until he was 19 and hadn't broken par until he was 22. Earlier in the year, Yang had been forced to sink a 7-foot putt on the final hole of the last day of qualifying school just to make the tour. He had a grand total of one victory on the PGA Tour. He was the longest of long shots to beat Woods. All day long, Woods and Steve Williams barely said a word to Yang, employing the kind of gamemanship, isolation, slow play, crowding Tiger was famous for. But Yang never got rattled. After 12 holes, he had pulled even with Woods. On 13, Woods stuffed a 3-iron from 248 yards to within 8 feet of the hole. When Yang buried his tee shot in a greenside bunker, it appeared a birdie-bogey swing was in the works and Woods was on his way to his 15th major. But then Yang hit the shot of his life, blasting out of the bunker to 12 feet. Moments later, he snaked in a tough putt for par. Still, all Woods had to do to stay even with Yang was make an 8-foot birdie putt, the kind he'd dropped hundreds of times under pressure. Only this time, the unthinkable happened. Woods missed. His putt burned the left edge of the cup and failed to fall. The look on Woods' face was a mix of anger and disbelief. Inside the clubhouse, players, many of whom had crumbled in similar pressure-packed situations against Woods, were jumping up and down on the couch, cheering Yang on, hoping somebody, anybody, even the South Korean son of a vegetable farmer, would finally slay the dragon. With five holes still to play, Woods had plenty of time to overtake Yang. But something was amiss. The failure to drop the kind of putt he hadn't missed, even under pressure in two decades, had shaken something loose in Tiger. When Yang chipped in for eagle on the next hole, Woods never recovered, missing two more critical makeable putts on the last four holes. He ended up losing to Yang by three strokes. His perfect record of 14-0 in winning majors after holding or sharing the third round lead was broken. Steve Williams later told a friend that he thought the loss of the PGA Championship to Yang was the first crack in the armor. It was the beginning of what he called the snowball effect. In his 2006 book, Golf at the Top, Williams described the effect as an unexpected moment that allows a flash of self-doubt to enter the conscious mind and then to penetrate all the way to the imagination. Then, having opened a wound in the most sensitive part of the brain, the person begins to listen more and more closely to the negative interpretations the imagination is placing on events and project them onto the next shot and the next round and the next tournament. In other words, when you miss once, when it really counts, like an 8-foot birdie putt late at the PGA Championship, the dark whispers in your mind grow louder and louder. As summer turned to fall, Woods was hearing such whispers seemingly at every turn. Weeks after losing to Yang at the PGA, he came unglued at the Deutsche Bank Championship in Massachusetts, throwing his driver in a fit of anger. Then at the Australian Masters in November, he lost his temper again. After a bad tee shot, he threw his club down with such force that it landed in the gallery. It could easily have injured someone. Hank Haney was watching the outburst on television and thought to himself, This is a troubled guy. The problems in Australia ran deeper than Haney or Williams ever imagined. Back on August 29th, Woods had sent a series of dark, denigrating texts to porn star Jocelyn James, another mistress, that signaled his state of mind. 4:08 p.m. Hold you down while I choke you and fuck that ass that I own. 4:10 p.m. Then I'm going to tell you to shut the fuck up while I slap your face and pull your hair for making noise. 5:00 p.m. I really do want to be rough with you. Slap you around. 5:15 p.m. I want you to beg for my cock. Kiss you all over to convince me to let you have it in your mouth. 5:26 p.m. Next time I see you, you better beg. And if you don't do it right, I will slap, spank, bite, and fuck you till mercy. In October, he was texting Jamie Grubbs, the cocktail waitress from San Diego. I will see you Sunday night. It's the only night in which I am totally free. If that wasn't enough, Woods was reportedly hooking up with a 27-year-old marketing manager for a Las Vegas nightclub, confiding to her that he wasn't happy in his marriage and telling her how much pressure he felt. In the middle of October, Woods was back at it with Grubbs, hoping to arrange a rendezvous in Newport Beach. But on the 18th, he texted, "Change of plans. Meet me at the Island Hotel. It's a little safer. Got us a room for the night. Room 905. It's on the east side of Fashion Island." Then he followed up with further instructions. "It's under the name Bell. Mr. and Mrs. Brian Bell." At the same time, Woods was arranging a rendezvous with Rachel Yucatel. Acting on a tip, the National Enquirer was hot on Tiger's trail once again. Back in 2007, it had seemed like a coup when IMG and sophisticated lawyers managed to squelch the Enquirer story about Woods and the Pancake House waitress in Orlando. But after that great escape, Tiger overlooked the fact that tabloids are like sharks that can detect prey from the scent of a single drop of blood in the water. Once Woods was wounded in 07, the Enquirer never stopped tracking him, and after Yucatel entered the picture, the chase was on. The tabloid staked out her apartment and waited to see what would happen. "It just became, well, let's follow her," said a source at the Enquirer. "Following people looks good on TV. But in real life, the success rate is like 2%. Amazingly, this actually worked out all the way right up to the room. The room in question turned out to be a suite on a special floor at the Crown Towers in Melbourne, Australia, where Woods was staying during the Australian Masters. Yucatel was headed there after receiving this email from Brian Bell. Here are the details for all the flights. Sorry for all the changes. I look forward to meeting you tomorrow. Bell was a critical cog in the setting up and maintaining of the secrecy of Tiger's trysts, but this time a surveillance team photographed Yucatel's arrival at the Melbourne Airport and Hotel. Then, as she entered an elevator on her way to the 35th floor, an Enquirer reporter slipped inside and confronted her as she walked to Woods' suite. At first, Yucatel denied any connection to Woods, but the futility of that approach quickly became apparent. She eventually returned to the U.S., leaving Team Tiger to sort out how to handle its most explosive scandal to date. While performing a staggering juggling act in his private life, Tiger won the Australian Masters by 2 strokes and pocketed a $3 million appearance fee. Afterward, he talked at length with Australian golf writers about the nuances of shot-making. "I felt this was a tricky golf course in a sense," he said. "It's not overly long, but you can hit marginal shots and have them in pretty bad spots. You had to make sure that you understood where to miss the golf ball. That's one of the things that I love on a golf course. It gets fast like this, and you have to maneuver the golf ball correctly." Woods' press conference was an insightful illustration of the compartmentalization performed by a man living a double life. At a time when he was careening toward a steep cliff that threatened to expose his duplicity and ravage his marriage, he calmly talked about the thrill he derived from shaping a shot away from danger zones. Immune for so long to the responsibilities of everyday life, Woods had, no doubt, developed a gaping blind spot that covered the consequences of his narcissistic ways, enabling him to believe he could cheat on his wife with impunity and forever escape detection. On the other hand, it's also possible that the high-stakes risks he was taking with so many women, arranging clandestine trysts and lying about his singular devotion to each woman on his overgrown list of paramours, may have breathed